Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and answers from people who make decisions. You will, I hope, leave knowing a little more than when you arrived. Coming up. The African National Congress at another crossroads as the National General Council tests power and policy at a pivotal moment. Agriculture rebounds, with 2026 shaping up as the sector's strongest year in a decade. South Africa's chartered accountants named the most trusted in the world, and water tasting emerges as the Cape Winelands' latest luxury experience. It's Thursday, the 11th of December. As the ANC holds its National General Council this week, the party finds itself, I think, at another juncture, beset by internal rumour, constant leadership speculation, and obviously the fallout from its disappointing performance in the election last year. A lot of questions swirling over President Ramaphosa's future within the movement, and also a reshaped contest for power among emerging frontrunners. So let's talk about this, and I'm in conversation with the Daily Maverick's Ferial Hafagi, who has been following all of this very closely. Ferial, you know, I always hate starting an interview with that old media trope question about the mood, but I think in this particular case, it's fairly apt. What are you discerning in Boksburg at the moment? What are you hearing? What are you seeing?
You know, I think the mood question is really important, Jeremy. So what I'm discerning is a far more sober-minded, less celebratory or populist National General Council than I've seen, and I've been to all of them. I think this is because the ANC lost its majority last year. And if you read through its base document, you'll see in there a lot of self-flagellation or excoriating self-criticism of where the party finds itself. So it's a very honest and, I would say, sober or even a somber mood.
Talking about itself, but the NGC, Ferial, is also meant to debate policy. To what extent is that happening?
Not really. Because it is in a government of national unity, I'm not seeing any really big policy shifts coming. I'll listen out for the economic policy briefing, which happens this afternoon. But other than the National Health Insurance System, or the NHI as we call it, I haven't seen any big moments around radical changes to economic policy, anything different on land, only really an insistence that the NHI will be implemented. And that has been a lobby that's been easy to foresee in the past few months.
And no real surprises here. A lot of talk of removing President Ramaphosa. That is dominating. Is this just rhetoric or a real threat?
I have to say that I didn't feel that. I had read everything in the run-up and very carefully listened out for that. And I, in fact, think what the party wants is a united front, and that especially after the G20, it did feel to me like President Ramaphosa's position, like there will not be a move to unseat him, and his term is up in 2027. What is pretty clear now is that the race for who succeeds him has opened up quite substantially.
So new succession frontrunners then are starting to emerge. Are we seeing factional positioning at this point, or is a lot of it driven by grassroots sentiment?
There's a very interesting piece written by Carol Payton, which is that the Veterans League, and it has a lot of support, I think, in the parties, that they're moving to change how the party elects its leadership, to take away the power of branch delegates and, in fact, give one member one vote in the election. The party is much smaller than it's been. It used to be 1.4 million people in 2020. It's now down to, I think, 530,000 members. So they are looking at changing how they elect leadership, because what we have seen to now is buying branches, buying members ahead of conferences. You saw it again in the rumors of it in the Johannesburg regional contest last week. So I did find that proposal very interesting, and I want to see if it passes muster.
You spoke about the internal flagellation, which is a lovely turn of phrase. Is there talk or increasing talk about maybe shifting away from the GNU before 2029, or is that is it too early to call that?
No, the documents suggest that the party wants to stay in the GNU as it's configured at the moment. That is a 10-party GNU. The Northwest Province did speak about reconfiguring it, and that's often language which means leave the DA out and let's do the ANC plus 10, which gives it a very simple majority. I don't think that that's got mass support at the moment, but we do have to go in and check with, say, the Eastern Cape, KZN and Limpopo, which now is the province of the ANC with the highest number of branches and of members.
Whichever way you look at it, though, the party does need to look at structural reform to stay relevant and a governing force moving forward.
It certainly does. All while it says that its goal with this National General Council is to make itself strong again so that it can win a majority of votes, that it returns to being the liberation movement which saw itself as representative of the South African people, I think that ship has pretty much sailed. All polls, all indicators suggest that it is going to head down toward, it's at about 41% support according to the latest Ipsos poll taken in winter, and none of the people I speak to think that it's possible for the party to get a majority again. So definitely coalitions and power sharing will determine its future.
One of South Africa's most astute political writers from the Daily Maverick, Ferial Hafaji, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Agriculture, it seems, is finishing this year in far better shape than it started. After a year of drought, disease and an 8.7% GDP contraction in 2024, the sector has turned sharply upward. There is growth, confidence and machinery sales all pointing to one of the better outlooks in years. Joining me now is Paul Makube, Senior Agricultural Economist at FNB Commercial, on what's changed and whether the momentum is real or temporary. And Paul, a very warm welcome to you. And let me start with that. We have seen these boom-bust cycles before. What makes this rebound different, do you think, from past false dawns?
Yes, thanks for having me again. Yes, you're talking about boom and bust. Currently, I think the current spread of growth is underpinned by a turnaround in weather conditions. I think with the La Nina back in the fold, it meant that we see production improving, excellent harvest, especially for grains and or field crops and horticulture. That has boosted output this year. And then we had excellent exports as well that carried the momentum.
Paul, let's get to exports in just a moment, but as far as La Nina rains are concerned, how dependent is this recovery on that condition? And how much risk is there if the conditions reverse?
Yeah, so if we talk agriculture, we cannot divorce ourselves from weather pattern. Agriculture is highly dependent on weather pattern. Therefore, the return of La Nina or El Nino influences the agricultural fortunes one way or another. So it's highly dependent on that. The good news is that we are heading into another season of La Nina, which means excellent production conditions and a decent harvest expected in the next year. The good thing about it is that if you have two consecutive years of La Nina weather pattern, it means that your reserves, water reserves are actually properly replenished, with water tables rising and also reservoirs, being replenished. So then you can have, if you have the weather pattern turning around, it doesn't have a, you know, a big impact on the on the output, meaning that we are unlikely to have a serious contraction in output.
Paul, exports, as you mentioned, are up around 10% in spite of tariffs. Do you think this is resilience or maybe luck that could turn quickly?
I think it's a combination of resilience and almost like luck that has to do with the U.S. tariffs. So what has happened on the international market is that the tariffs has created panic in the world market. Countries are actually re-looking at their, trading regimes and therefore looking elsewhere for products. And that opens up for, South Africa's produce. And hence we saw that high demand for South African produce going to almost all these other markets, especially the Asian market, yes.
And Paul, interesting to note that machinery sales have jumped. Does this maybe mean, though, that farmers are taking on more debt than they should at this point in the cycle?
Not necessarily more debt, but it's a question of also with bumper crops, especially if you look at it, it's mostly tractors and combine harvesters. Those are in the grain market, and therefore, that coincides with the bumper harvest, which means they are cash flush, and they're able to, replenish their stock. Of course, there is an element of uptake of debt, but obviously, also favorable in terms of interest rates having come down, that boosts their ability to replenish their stock.
And Paul, how widespread is this positive picture? In other words, are we seeing true broad-based growth across all farmers, or are the gains just concentrated among the larger commercial operators?
Well, not necessarily, broad-based in terms of sectors or industries. You look at the horticulture and fruit crops, those are the beneficiaries of the current spread. The livestock sector, took a hit, particularly cattle, due to the outbreak of foot and mouth disease. So that value chain, took a hammering. And in fact, if you look at the GDP numbers, if it was not, foot and mouth disease, the sector which is biggest, the livestock, we could have had an even better performance from the agricultural sector. So disease outbreaks have impacted on the livestock sector, and hence there was a mixed, outcome for the industries. The horticulture and fruit crops have benefited, while the livestock sector, faced challenges.
And that's a very worrying situation, because it begs the question, if disease management, as you're suggesting, remains a weakness, why haven't we fixed biosecurity after years and years of warnings?
Yeah, so we woke up late, probably, but I think we were aware of the potential devastation. But I think perhaps the good news is that efforts currently they've made miles in terms of attending to this matter, and the announcement of vaccination across the board is one step in the right direction in terms of ensuring that the issue of biosecurity is ultimately handled. But I think you're right, we have to have that vigilance around biosecurity, not only in cattle, but also we had a challenge with avian influenza. So biosecurity remains a challenge for South Africa, especially for the biggest industry that has a huge impact on the agricultural sector.
Thank you very much indeed. Paul Makube, Senior Agricultural Economist at FNB Commercial. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's chartered accountants have again been named the most trusted in the world in the new 2025 Edelman DXI CAW survey. Now, it's a major endorsement, I think, for the CA designation, but it also comes as SAICA's own trust scores have slipped. So I think there must be questions around ethics, transparency, and also transformation broadly in the profession. Let's pull all of that together. The chief executive officer of SAICA is Patricia Stock, and she joins me on the program now. Patricia, a very warm welcome to you. So on the one hand, some good news, trust rising, but your own indicators have fallen. What's behind the disconnect? What explains that?
Jeremy, thank you so much for this opportunity to engage. And what we appreciate is a balanced view in the index themselves. And it also reaffirms the areas that we had already identified in our transition in terms of the target operating model that we're working with in terms of areas that we need to invest in. But what is not a surprise, Jeremy, is that what we've also seen is that it's areas where it matters that are in the public interest, for example, you know, member discipline matters that we were dealing with previously. So it's one of the areas that have contributed towards that the decline, as an example. But what's encouraging is that, you know, the CASA designation still recognized as number one trusted designation globally. It reaffirms what we stand for, that even despite, you know, the challenges that we've seen with cases that we had to deal with and those that we are dealing with even currently, you know, with recent matters that we are dealing with, you know, it reaffirms the fact that we've got rigorous processes and that the profession broadly stands for trust, because that's our number one equity in terms of wherever we do work in the broader ecosystem. Because most of our members, in fact, our members, they assume significant roles in the ecosystem, and the functions that we fulfill are in the positions of trust.
Mm.
So that's why for us it's such an important aspect to ensure that we safeguard that. And obviously safeguarding that is ensuring that, you know, we have zero tolerance to misconduct, especially around unethical conduct, and that's how we continuously strengthen our member discipline processes, but and also to ensure that our members remain trusted from capabilities perspective, and hence the investment in sustainability and AI, you know, as to ensure that our members have got the right skills that are required in the future. It's a journey that we're already on, and we're excited about it, Jeremy, that it's not only with the members that are qualified, but we're already integrating all of those, you know, key elements, even at the university level when we look at our curriculum and our training program.
You've raised the issue of difficulties, perhaps ethics issues, but transformation in the industry, Patricia, does remain slow. Are there new, harder accountability measures that you're going to enforce moving forward that will change that?
Jeremy, that is certainly an area that we continue to invest in and focus on, and it requires the entire ecosystem to invest in that. And in DASA, we are advocates for transformation, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, as an institute as well. So definitely we'll continue along that path. It has been a focus of SAICA for the past 22 years, for that matter. And when we look at when you talk about the indicators, currently we're sitting at 37% of ACI representation. And we know, we believe that when we look at the country demographics, there's definitely more work to be done. But with that said, Jeremy, especially when we talk about trust in our profession and the designation, we are deliberate and intentional to ensure that transformation is not a trade-off for quality of our programs, which we believe that it's what is resulting in ensuring that this profession that we represent of having CAs, you know, globally remains trusted, and that we do not compromise on the quality of our programs whatsoever.
Patricia, on a broader level, being most trusted is one thing, but how is SAICA going to make the profession more relevant to South Africa's current economic challenges? What needs to change?
Jeremy, it's what needs to be scaled up, right, for us, because the profession, we are committed to ensuring that we remain economically and socially relevant, and which is the work, in fact, it aligns with our strategic focus areas. For example, we've just done work in partnership with the government in terms of ensuring that the country gets off the fate of grey listing. I mean, our members did significant amount of work, of course, ourselves as an institute as well. Those are some of the areas in terms of how do we turn policy into action to ensure that we can remain attractive as a destination of choice when it comes to investment, right? So one of the key areas of focus as well is around sustainability, because what we're seeing globally, you know, to enable access to capital and then also debt raising, because we know from sovereign debt perspective, we'll still rely on debt as a country, but sustainability we're seeing is one of the key factors that are coming in, you know, from investors as well. So for us, it's to ensure that the country has got enough capacity, you know, to be able to not only report, but have the right skilled people, you know, to enable sustainable practices. But then also with AI adoption as well, Jeremy, I mean, it's no longer a choice of whether you adopt AI or not. So for us as well, it's to ensure that we we can also have members that have got not only members, but where our members are leading, that they can drive the adoption of AI responsibly in a human-centric manner and keeping humans in the
loop. Well, let me ask you about AI as a final question. How are you going to ensure that adoption of artificial intelligence doesn't, in fact, Patricia, deepen inequality between well-resourced and smaller practices? That's a big issue that you need to get your head around.
Absolutely. And we're already seeing that trend, right, in terms of, you know, the larger, we're seeing larger firms that are moving at a much faster pace than when we look at the SMEs and the SMPs. And that's why, how, you know, finding ways to ensure that when it comes to enterprise development as well, that we're intentional to channel funding towards AI-related initiatives as well. But even with us as an institute, in collaboration with, you know, our partners as well in the ecosystem, that we find ways to, look at the capital that's available and also consolidate where we can and work in collaboration so that we can scale up the impact that we can make for the SMEs as well. Because we know funding is one of the significant challenges when it comes to SME development. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. Patricia Stock is the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institute for Chartered Accountants. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in the Cape Winelands, there is, I read, a new luxury experience, and it's not wine. A Stellenbosch estate is offering water tastings at 295 Rand per person, where guests, as I understand it, compare still and sparkling mineral waters from around the world, all created by a certified water sommelier. It's part of a growing trend in high-end tourism, where purity, terroir, and provenance are applied to water just as they are to wine. So I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Nico Pieterse, international water sommelier, to explain why people are paying to taste water and what they think they're getting. Nico, a very warm welcome to you, and be patient with me. For listeners who haven't heard of water tasting before, what exactly are they experiencing and why is it worth it?
Hi, Jeremy. I'll tell you all of those things. Thank you for having me on the show. Water is not just water, and water from all sources around the world tastes differently because of the minerals in the soil. So you can get very unique waters from around the world. Some of it may be from volcanic origin, or basically water that rained on or around a volcano, then siphons through into an aquifer, and you get loads and loads of minerals in that water. Where the other one, the opposite, would be water from a glacier in Svalbard or in Lofoten Islands in Norway, where you get a glacier that's maybe been around for 200,000 years. The glacier is now melting, and before that water can run into the ocean and become salt water, they will bottle that. And it's quite an emotional experience to have a glass of water that fell as rain about 200,000 years ago. So as a sommelier, what I then do is I take that the taste of that water, and I pair that with a wine or a whiskey or a brandy or for some food, and it makes the wine or the brandy or the whiskey or the food actually complements the wines and the whiskies, which is really interesting, and it's not something you'd expect water to do. But from all the waters in the world, and there are loads and loads of sources all around the world and in South Africa, we look at the minerals inside that water, and that water, the more minerals, the more taste the water would have.
How does South African water stack up then?
South Africa's got quite low, so we measure the minerals in TDS, or total dissolved solids. Now, in the tasting room, I have a local water that I use with a TDS of 345, which is, that's milligram per liter, and that would be the highest one in South Africa that's commercially available. In the tasting also, I go up to about a TDS of 4,700. It's a water from Armenia with very high mineral content. And it's a very interesting tasting water. So the TDS is 4,700 on the Armenian one. And that also has a very interesting story, because with still water, I love pairing still water with wine, because once we carbonate water, carbonation, or the CO2, is acidic and it lowers the pH of the water. So I don't like pairing carbonated water with wine necessarily. I love pairing it with food or sparkling wine, whether still waters are love pairing with a red or a white, and it just goes better with that.
Nico, South Africans, I think it's fair to say, are wine literate. Do you think that makes us more open to the idea that water can be tasted, differentiated, and enjoyed as well?
I absolutely think so. In the tasting, which takes about an hour, half an hour of that is purely educational, and I tell the taster everything I can about water and how important water is. So I'm a water steward. I'm a supporter of water, and I protect water. But I also want to educate, and there's a lot that people don't know about water, and water really is the most important thing on earth for human beings. There really isn't anything else for health and for survival, except maybe the sun. But I think South Africans have a lot to learn about water. I think the whole world has a lot to learn about water, and on my own at my little tasting room, I try and change the world one tasting at a time.
What's been the reaction from guests so far? Is it curiosity, excitement, or maybe, as I started this conversation with you, a degree of skepticism?
100% skepticism, but that's changed in the first 15 minutes of the tasting, and I've yet to have a person who didn't weren't able to taste the differences in the water and appreciate the tasting. It really is. It's an important bit of education that people really need to have. I think if I have to, on a social media platform, on an article, I'd get very interesting comments because people think water is just water, but it really isn't. And the fact that I have so many comments on social media about I'd rather buy a whiskey or a brandy and coke or I'd rather drink water from the hose. I mean, those myths all get fixed up in the tasting. Once we know a little bit about water, you either love me or you hate me, because I get you to read your mineral bottle labels, and I get you to understand what really is in tap water. And so tap water is really it's necessary 100% because we need water, but it's also the most processed water in the world. So you just need to know what to look for in tap water and what to possibly take out if you can.
Can I push you a little bit on taste? You talk about the terroir in water. Can you give me a practical example of how water from one region tastes different from another? But maybe if you can verbalize or articulate the actual taste itself.
It's not a difficult question. So the minerals basically are salts. And the salts are electrolytes, and that's what we need for survival. So I would imagine if you consider there's a product that you add to water, to your glass of water after you've, I don't want to say the name necessarily, but it's a hydration product. It's a little packet with them. So that guy. So without the sweetness, that would be a higher TDS water. So if you think about that without the sugar in it or the sweetness in it, it's salty. It is sometimes it's very smooth, depending on whether you have magnesium in there. Magnesium and calcium and silica makes the water smooth, and that goes really well with a red wine. Where a water without that goes really well with a white wine. If you say you want a coffee that's a nicer brew coffee, you use a water with a high magnesium content, because the magnesium extracts more sugar out of the coffee bean, and it also makes your coffee smoother. So it's a mouthfeel. It's definitely salty because the minerals are salts. Alkalinity can affect the taste on the sweetness side. So if the water is more alkaline, it will taste a little bit sweeter. And also it might, the texture might be a little bit more soapy. But yeah, you get wonderful waters out there, and it's a conversation that needs hours to discuss.
Nico Peters, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for talking to me today, International Water Sommelier. I do appreciate your time. And on that H2O note, we're going to end today's program. You have been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.